This recording is a service of the Allen County Public Library's audio reading service. It is specifically designed for and directed to people who have visual, physical, learning, or language challenges to reading traditional printed materials.
Welcome to Science News. We'll explore the latest research and the intersection of science and society. There's always something fascinating to learn in Science News, coming up next on the audio reading service.
Welcome, this is Science News, and I'm your reader, Bill Shaw, with the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Today I'll be reading from the sciencenews.org website, copyright 2025, Society for Science and the Public. And now I'll begin with, from the News of Health and Medicine, chemicals in marijuana may affect women's fertility. A new study offers some of the first hints at how THC affects female fertility by Sofia Caetano Avritzer. When Canada legalized cannabis in 2018, its effects on human health were all over the news. Cynthia Duval, a women's health researcher at the University of Toronto at the time, wondered how its consumption might affect female fertility. To her surprise, there was almost no information on the subject, though there was plenty of data on marijuana's effects on pregnancy and male fertility. Chemicals in cannabis may push eggs to become ready for fertilization, but this may come at a cost: more eggs with the wrong number of chromosomes. Duval and colleagues now report in a study published September 9th in Nature Communications. Delta-9-tetrahydrocannabinol, or THC, is the main psychoactive chemical in marijuana. It binds to cannabinoid receptors in the brain, but these receptors are all over our bodies, including in our reproductive organs. The receptors usually bind endocannabinoids, molecules naturally produced by the body and essential for normal bodily functions like the production of eggs and sperm. Consuming THC can affect cannabinoid receptors in the reproductive system. Many studies report that using cannabis decreases sperm count and motility. Men are usually told to avoid cannabis for at least 3 months before trying to conceive, Duval says. But what about women? That has been hard to answer. Women are born with a set number of immature eggs in their ovaries. After puberty, a single egg will mature every month, becoming ready for fertilization. One of the few ways to study women's eggs is during in vitro fertilization, or IVF. For IVF, women receive hormones that make multiple eggs mature at once, which are then collected to create embryos. Duval, who works at Create Fertility Center, an IVF clinic in Toronto, analyzed eggs and fluid collected from 1,059 women who had IVF in the clinic from 2016 to 2023. She found THC in the fluid collected with the eggs from 62 of the women. Women with higher THC levels around their eggs had larger numbers of mature eggs. But when Duval artificially matured eggs and exposed them to THC, she found they often had the wrong number of chromosomes, which could lead to failure to form embryos, unsuccessful uterine implantation, and non-viable pregnancies. Only a much larger study could say if this decreases women's chances of conceiving, Duval says, but the results hint at THC's effect on female fertility. Quote, we have information about the male part, we have information about pregnancy, but there was a gap, Duval says. And from the News of Health and Medicine, the brain preserves maps of missing hands for years. The results call into question theories of large-scale brain reorganization after limb loss by Laura Sanders. The brain holds space for a missing limb even years after it's gone. For three women who underwent planned hand amputations, brain scans revealed remarkably durable maps of hand areas lasting for 5 years. In one case, the results published August 21st in Nature Neuroscience, counter the long-held idea that the adult brain remakes itself in prominent ways after a change to the body, such as an amputation. Earlier research, much of it on rodents and non-human primates, suggested that after a limb was gone, the brain's real estate shifts. It was thought that the brain area that used to receive input from a missing hand would be taken over by neighboring areas, particularly those corresponding to the face and lips. But that idea doesn't fit with a common phenomenon. People often retain vivid sensations of their missing limb, including what's known as phantom pain, says Hunter Schoen, a neuroscientist at the University of Pittsburgh. Quote, these two ideas of the brain is completely changing and the amputee experience saying, quote, I can still feel the limb are very much in conflict with each other, end quote. Schoen and his colleagues set out to see how the brain adjusts or doesn't after amputation. The study depended on three women facing planned hand amputations, each of whom agreed to functional MRI brain scans before and after their surgeries. Quote, they offered their time at one of the most difficult periods of their lives, Schoen says. During the scans, the women moved their fingertips one at a time, curled their toes, and pursed their lips. These small movements triggered changes in blood flow in the brain that marked activity in the primary somatosensory cortex, a neural strip that runs up each side of the brain from just above the ear to the top of the head. This area handles signals from the body, including touch, pain, and spatial position. The neural real estate there remained unchanged after amputation, follow-up brain scans showed. When the women attempted to move their missing fingers one at a time, the same brain activity patterns showed up as before, even though the fingers weren't there. And pursing their lips didn't lead to any new activity in the hand area, suggesting that the lips didn't expand into this territory. The hand maps were sturdy. When one woman was scanned 5 years after surgery, her hand map showed no overt differences. Those results fit with scans of 26 other amputees that the team analyzed. Quote, there is really strong, consistent evidence in pretty much every amputee that I scan that there is persistent representation of their missing hand, says Tamar Macken, a cognitive neuroscientist at the University of Cambridge. By comparing the three women's brains before and after surgery, the study design, quote, is a powerful way to say, at the macroscopic global scale, we can't really detect the strong reorganization, says Dan Feldman, a neuroscientist at the University of California, Berkeley, who was not involved in the new research. However, he cautions, quote, that doesn't mean reorganization is not there at the local scale and may be doing important things, end quote. But on bigger scales, such as those detected by fMRI, quote, maybe the maps are not changing, end quote. The finding may have implications for the design of better prosthetics and treatments for phantom limb pain, which is common and sometimes debilitating for people who have lost limbs. Some approaches aim to stop or shift purported brain rewiring, but Schoen says they're based on flawed reasoning. Quote, to me, our study says we need to stop chasing or trying to fix broken brain maps that aren't actually broken. End quote. And now from the news of animals. Just like humans, many animals get more aggressive in the heat. Hotter temperatures spark aggression in species from salamanders to monkeys, by Katarina Zimmer. Humans aren't the only animals with hot tempers. In 2016, ecologist Kristen Cesala and a colleague watched black-bellied salamanders from Appalachian streams lunge at one another inside a lab incubator. The little animals, barely a hand's length, can be fiercely territorial, thrashing to bite their opponents or send them fleeing, says Cesala of the University of the South in Sewanee, Tennessee. Quote, Salamander Fight Club, as Cesala calls the experiment, was set up to test how rising temperatures would affect the amphibians' behavior. Black-bellied salamanders, it turned out, were nearly four times as likely to act aggressively at 25 degrees Celsius. much warmer than their stream habitats compared with more natural conditions at 15 degrees or 20 degrees Celsius. And salamanders aren't alone in their raucous behavior. Studies show that many animals, monkeys, rats, mice, fish, ants, tend to get more aggressive at higher temperatures. As the planet warms due to climate change, rising temperatures could subtly affect some species' social structures and ecosystems. But the findings may also tell us something deeper about how heat affects animals physiologically and potentially reveal clues to increased violence and crime among humans in hot weather. Quote, "We're all products of the environment and our biology," says Klaus Lindmann, a neuroscientist at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston, who is studying the heat aggression link in humans. Not every animal responds to heat with aggression. In Sasala's experiment, only black-bellied salamanders and not seal or Okoe salamanders showed this trend. But among those that do, many are ectotherms, cold-blooded creatures that use environmental conditions to regulate their body temperature. In one 2024 study, freshwater biologist Erin Francis Pillay and her colleagues placed blunt-nosed minnows in tanks where temperatures fluctuated from 18 degrees to 24 degrees Celsius within a day, a change that mimics similar conditions documented in streams that have lost shade due to deforestation. At higher temperatures, the small fish behaved more aggressively toward their shoal mates compared with fish kept at constant temperatures. Quote, "They were just like nipping at each other a lot," says Francis Pillay of McGill University in Montreal. And in a 2023 study spanning the European Alps, ecologist Patrick Krapf and his colleagues reported that Tetramorium alpestre ants inhabiting warmer alpine regions tend to be more hostile. When two worker ants from different colonies are placed in a little glass, quote, arena, end quote, they're often combative toward one another. Warmth-accustomed ants tended to be especially aggressive, baring their mandibles or pulling at opponents' limbs. Quote, "They start really fighting, like grappling," says Krapf of the University of Innsbruck in Austria. One possible explanation for this heat aggression link in ectotherms is that warmth dials up the animals' metabolisms, using more of their energy. This requires more calories, making animals more territorial and aggressive to secure food. For salamanders, Sasala says, quote, "They're less willing to let other individuals perhaps come into their territories in a situation where they're feeling a little bit calorie limited," end quote. For ants, Krapf suspects that simpler explanations are possible. The insect's food, honeydew excreted by aphids, is more abundant at warmer temperatures, giving them more energy to spend on behaviors like aggression. By contrast, warm-blooded endotherms like mammals may be less sensitive to these effects, Francis Pillay says, because they can cool their bodies through sweating or panting, for instance. But the heat aggression association has been documented in some monkeys, rats, mice, and according to Lindman's research, even dogs. Even for endotherms, warmth boosts metabolic rates and calorie loss may be exacerbated by the energy needed to cool their bodies, Francis Pillay says. When the priority is getting more calories, less energy may go toward maintaining social behaviors and regulating aggression, she speculates. Yet Lindman suggests that increased aggression could also arise from the discomfort that warm-blooded animals feel in hot weather. In humans, scientists debate the extent to which the aggression-heat relationship is due to biological effects of heat on behavior versus increased outdoor activities on hot days, but, quote, "as the heat-aggression correlation is consistent across multiple species, it suggests that simple sociological explanations are not sufficient," Lindman says. There is indeed some evidence that heat can affect brain chemistry and connectivity, potentially leading to aggressive behavior, says environmental neuroscientist Kim Miedenbauer of Washington State University in Pullman. Quote, "Uncomfortable, stressful heat affects a number of psychological and physiological processes that can lead to increased aggression," she says. While scientists investigate the underlying mechanisms and important questions, such as whether aggression disappears once animals get used to heat, they're also thinking about possible consequences of the heat-aggression relationship as the world warms. If ants become increasingly aggressive, Krapf speculates, quote, they might get rid of other nearby colonies of the same species, end quote, enlarging colonies' spatial structures. Greater aggression in minnows could lead to less cohesive shoals, making it easier for predators to pick off individual fish. Battle-prone amphibians might keep greater distances from one another, decreasing their population density and potentially making them more vulnerable to decline, Sisala says. By subtly tweaking physiology, climate change can influence animal behavior in unexpected ways. For the salamanders of Appalachian streams, fight clubs may be becoming a little more intense. And our next article from the News of Planetary Science. Seismic waves suggest Mars has a solid heart. The purported solid inner core has a radius of about 600 kilometers. By Mackenzie Perlman. Mars may have a hardened heart. Marsquake reverberations detected by NASA's InSight lander revealed that the red planet probably possesses a solid inner core. Researchers report in the September 4th Nature that firm interior tucked within a liquid outer core could help researchers better understand Mars' evolutionary history from late 2018 to late 2022. InSight sat atop Mars' surface and listened to tremors from more than 1,300 Marsquakes to probe the planet's innards. When seismic waves travel through Mars' interior, they can bounce off or bend at the boundaries of different layers, uncovering clues about what lies deep within. Quote, we're building a picture of the inside of the planet, but we hadn't yet seen evidence of a solid inner core, says seismologist Vedran Lekic of the University of Maryland in College Park, who wasn't involved in the new study. InSight data previously hinted at the presence of a liquid metal core, but researchers remain unsure if it also has a solid component like Earth's center. Seismologist Daoyun Sun of the University of Science and Technology of China in Hefei and colleagues examined 23 low-frequency Marsquakes whose epicenters, the surface locations at or above the quake's origins, were about 1,600 to 2,400 kilometers away from the lander. Some of these Marsquake waves traveled through the planet's core, reflecting off its far side. Tremors travel more quickly through a hard medium than a fluid one, and the studied waves arrived at InSight around 50 to 200 seconds earlier than they should have if the core was purely liquid. Quote, that gave us some ideas that there must be some faster stuff in the very center, end quote. Possibly something solid, Sun says. Further analysis revealed waves that had ricocheted off a border between an inner core and an outer core, which could be there only if Mars has a solid heart. Based on various seismic waves, travel speeds, and paths, Sun and his colleagues calculated that the inner core's radius is roughly 600 kilometers, about one-fifth of Mars' thickness. Computer simulations considering core density and wave speeds through the planet's heart hint that the mostly iron and nickel core might contain the lighter element oxygen within its hard interior, and certain percentages of sulfur, oxygen, and carbon are present in the liquid outer region. Quote, I'm more convinced by the findings than I thought I would be, Lekic says. The authors have, quote, clearly detected something cool, end quote. Still, he questions whether the specified percentages of elements could realistically exist in the core at temperatures consistent with prior knowledge about Mars' interior. But geophysicist Amir Khan of ETH Zurich is skeptical of the author's interpretation of the data. Quote, I was surprised, slightly bewildered, end quote, by the results, he says, quote, it was not what we're expecting to see, end quote. Previous work suggests that Mars has a large, low-density core, which implies the presence of light elements that would prevent a solid inner core from forming, he says. Even if one had emerged, it would probably be tiny with a radius of 300 kilometers at most. It's tricky to distinguish useful waves from other signals within InSight's seismic data, Khan says. He suggests that other researchers use different methods to search the new paper's data set for signs of a solid inner core. A hardened heart could complicate scientists' understanding of Mars' history. Early in its lifetime, a magnetic field probably blanketed the planet, like on modern-day Earth. The magnetization of our home planet comes from both liquid core material crystallizing into a solid center and heat flowing out of the core. Many researchers suspect that Mars stopped generating its global magnetic field because it was driven only by heat escape, which weakened as the planet cooled. If the red planet contains a solid inner core, Sun says, new ideas would be needed to explain the loss of its widespread magnetization. And now from the news of paleontology, crystallized dino eggs provide a peek into the tumultuous late Cretaceous. Hidden crystals allow scientists to date fossils from a famous site in China for the first time, by Carolyn Gramling. Crystals hidden inside dinosaur eggs at a famous fossil site are giving scientists a chance to do something that's long proven elusive, figure out how old the ancient nests really are. Finding these fossilized eggs' true shelf life makes it possible to connect large-scale changes in climate to tiny shifts in the structure of eggshells, the researchers report, September 11th in Frontiers in Earth Science. That in turn offers a new way to assess the ancient environments in which the dinosaurs nested. The Qinglongshan assemblage in central China contains over 3,000 dinosaur eggs of unknown parentage and, until now, uncertain age. But a clutch of 28 eggs at the site contains a secret clue, like an eggy geode. The fossils bear large crystals of the mineral calcium carbonate. That calcium carbonate contains trace amounts of uranium in its crystal structure, making it possible to geochemically date the fossils based on estimates of the rate of radioactive decay of uranium to lead. Analysis revealed that the eggs are about 86 million years old, deposited during the late Cretaceous period. By then, the planet had cooled down considerably from the hothouse temperatures of the mid-Cretaceous, and that drop in temperature could explain why the Qinglongshan eggs' shells are so porous, say geologist Qingmin Chen of the Shanxi Institute of Geology Survey in Xi'an, China, and colleagues. The number of pores, tiny holes in the shells that allow oxygen to enter and carbon dioxide to exit, can indicate environmental conditions such as humidity, temperature, or even how deeply buried a nest might have been. Being able to directly link environmental conditions to nesting sites is what makes this discovery so valuable, the team says. Dinosaur eggs are generally dated using indirect methods such as analyzing the surrounding rocks or ash or assessing the relative age of other fossils in the rocks. But those methods don't provide precise ages. Directly dating the eggs could therefore answer myriad questions, the researchers say, even about the final days of the dinosaurs. The geological basin that includes the Qinglongshan site also includes rocks that span the Cretaceous Paleogene boundary, the time period when an asteroid struck Earth 65 million years ago, kicking off a mass extinction event thought to have killed off all non-bird dinosaurs. And our next article is from the area of paleontology. Young pterosaurs probably died in violent Jurassic storms. Fossils from Germany suggest young flyers were felled by violent winds 150 million years ago by Carolyn Gramling. The broken wings of two young pterosaurs may reveal how hundreds of their kind met their end about 150 million years ago. New analysis of the well-preserved complete pterodactylus fossils dubbed, quote, lucky one, end quote, and, quote, lucky two, end quote, show that a humerus bone in each hatchling had been cleanly fractured at an oblique angle. This indicates that their arms were wrenched in a powerful twisting motion, researchers report, September 5th in Current Biology. The culprit was probably a violent windstorm that proved too powerful for the young animals, says paleontologist Robert Smith of the University of Leicester in England and his colleagues. The mystery of the pterosaur's demise is a cold case going back about 150 million years, when much of what's now Germany was covered by a warm, shallow sea. Coral reefs walled off the parts of that sea into isolated lagoons with thick, soft carbonate mud bottoms. Those muds created an excellent environment for fossilization, even of the fragile, lightweight bones of flying reptiles such as pterosaurs. One such lagoon is now a limestone quarry filled with Jurassic period fossils, including small dinosaurs and Archaeopteryx, the latest known bird. Known as the Solnhofen limestone, this ancient graveyard is especially renowned for its abundance of pterosaur fossils, particularly those of hatchlings. These fossils are helping researchers better understand pterosaurs' growth, paleontology, and when and how they could fly. Oddly, the site's adult pterosaur fossils tend to be found in bits and pieces, while the specimens of the younger individuals are beautifully complete. That's counterintuitive because the hatchling skeleton should be even more fragile than the older ones. Violent storms could explain this mystery, the researchers say. The young pterosaurs probably struggled against the wind, ultimately falling into the lagoon where they were drowned and quickly buried in the sediment, the team suggests. Older pterosaurs, meanwhile, might have struggled mightily in both the storms and the lagoon before succumbing. Their carcasses may then have been tossed about in the water before sinking, resulting in more scattered bones. The finding, the team notes, highlights how catastrophic storms can distort the fossil record by selectively preserving different specimens in different ways. And from the news of health and medicine, drugs like Ozempic might lower cancer risk. People taking GLP-1 meds tended to be less at risk of developing cancers linked to obesity. By Megan Rosen. Drugs like Ozempic could have anti-cancer powers. That's the conclusion of a new study that tracked the diabetes and weight loss medications liraglutide, semaglutide, or tirzepatide, which are sold under the brand names Saxenda, Wegovy, and Zepbound, among others. Overall, people on the drugs were less likely to develop cancer than those who had never tried them, researchers report August 21st in JAMA Oncology. This is early evidence that the drugs, quote, may have a potential benefit for the prevention of cancer, says Serena Jingchuan Guo, a pharmacoepidemiologist at Purdue University in West Lafayette, Indiana. Though these medications called GLP-1 drugs are known for their weight loss effects, they offer a bundle of other health benefits too. They can reduce heart attack risk, may ease migraines, and could even curb addiction, scientists have shown. But the drugs come with a long list of side effects, and researchers are still sorting out potential harms and benefits even as new versions are released, Guo says. Her team wanted to see how the drugs influenced cancer risk, in particular cancers linked to obesity. The researchers combed through electronic health records from nearly 90,000 people in Florida who were overweight or obese and tracked the incidence of 14 different cancers over about a decade. These cancers include those of the liver, thyroid, bladder, and pancreas. Over this time period, the risk of developing any of the cancers dropped about 17% among people on the medications. That may not seem like a drastic change, says Guo, but, quote, even a small alteration of the risk means a potential big impact in the population, end quote. Take the number of people who tend to get cancer. In Guo's study, around 1,000 of the more than 40,000 people not on GLP-1s went on to develop the disease. Multiply that ratio by the number of obese or overweight people in the United States, over 200 million, and that's millions of potential cancer cases. Still, it's too early to say whether taking GLP-1s could help avert some of these cases, Guo says, and it's unclear exactly what the drugs may be doing to curb cancer, says Larry Norton, a medical oncologist at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York City. The reduced risk Guo's team observed could be a side effect of weight loss, or the drugs could be acting directly to somehow halt tumor growth. It's also possible the whole thing is a coincidence, he says. That's the tricky part with observational studies. You can spot associations, Norton says, but, quote, association and causation are extremely different. The full story is probably complex. Guo points out that the medication's effects are not likely to be one size fits all. Previous studies have already hinted, for instance, that a person's genetics might predict how much weight they lose on certain drugs. The same could be true for cancer risk. Guo is now expanding her analysis to include nationwide data. She hopes that doctors one day will be able to offer more personalized advice to patients by determining who may benefit most from the medications and who may be at risk. Though the meds' overall effect seemed to be cancer preventive, Guo's team also saw hints that GLP-1s might increase the risk of kidney cancer. It's something others have also reported, though Norton says he's not too worried. Quote, I think we have to keep watching it, but I would not say that as a reason to not use these drugs, he says. Scientists still have much to learn about the medications, Norton says, especially as newer and more powerful versions roll out. It's possible these newer drugs may offer better weight control and cancer prevention benefits, he says. Quote, we're just at the dawn of this incredibly interesting area of science, end quote. And now some news of Earth. 20 years after Hurricane Katrina, is the U.S. better prepared? Forecasts have gotten better, but climate change and funding cuts may reverse the gains, by Carolyn Gramling. In late August 2005, Hurricane Katrina devastated the U.S. Gulf Coast. The storm cut a deadly swath through Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama, deluging coastal towns as surges of ocean water swept relentlessly ashore, driven by powerful winds. The sheer force of the surging waters overpowered levees meant to protect low-lying New Orleans from floodwaters. The levees failed, and about 80% of the city was inundated. In all, the hurricane caused more than 1,800 fatalities, displaced hundreds of thousands of people from their homes, and was responsible for about $1.25 billion in property damage. It's one of the two costliest Atlantic hurricanes on record, tied with 2017's Hurricane Harvey. The scale of the devastation from Katrina also shoved the question of the country's readiness for such a catastrophic event into a glaring spotlight. The event highlighted critical gaps in hurricane forecasting and modeling, including how quickly a storm system can spin up into a major hurricane and how much ocean water its winds drive onto the shore, a phenomenon called storm surge. The response to the disaster was also worrisome. Federal aid to the region was slow, uncoordinated, and insufficient. Evacuation orders came less than a day before landfall, too late for many residents, and there was not enough shelter, food, or water for those left stranded. The Federal Emergency Management Agency, part of the Department of Homeland Security, was, quote, overwhelmed, end quote, by the scope of the disaster. Then Homeland Security Director Michael Chertoff told a Senate investigating committee in February 2006, quote, it is completely correct to say that our logistics capability was woefully inadequate, end quote. Significant anniversaries of a disaster can bring fresh attention to the event, creating, quote, a policy window when people are paying attention, end quote, says Andrew Rumbach, a researcher who studies the impacts of climate change and disasters with the nonprofit Urban Institute based in Washington, D.C. Quote, I think 20 years is a good time to really reflect on what has happened and what will happen in the future, end quote. In those two decades, there have been big leaps in forecasters' ability to determine where a hurricane will go and how powerful it will get, advances that can both save lives and reduce the punishing price tag of such catastrophes. But recent policy shifts in the national response to hurricane research and preparedness might counteract those gains, researchers say. Taken together, it's not at all clear that the country is better prepared for another Katrina. The genesis of a hurricane disaster. Katrina was one of 27 named storms in the Atlantic Ocean in 2005, a then record-breaking season fueled by high ocean temperatures and fostered by favorable patterns of wind and air pressure. On August 25th, Katrina was a Category 1 hurricane in the Atlantic. After making landfall in southeastern Florida, the team brushed across the peninsula, aiming for the Gulf of Mexico. The National Weather Service forecasts that the storm would then curve north back toward the Florida Panhandle for a second landfall. Instead, Katrina kept moving west over the Gulf, pulling in a ready supply of heat and moisture from a 100-meter thick layer of water, averaging 26 degrees Celsius. Within a day, the storm suddenly strengthened into a major Category 3 hurricane with winds up to 185 kilometers per hour. On August 28th, Katrina rapidly intensified again. Over 12 hours, the wind speeds increased from 185 kilometers per hour to 265 kilometers per hour. Hitting Category 5 hurricane status, the storm finally turned north toward Louisiana. Have forecasts improved since Katrina? The two great challenges of hurricane forecasting are predicting where a storm will go and how strong it will get, and both types of forecasts have improved dramatically over the last half century, noted MIT atmospheric scientist Carrie Emanuel and colleagues in 2019 in Science. Part of that improvement comes from better and more frequent observations, particularly from satellite remote sensing that offers abundant data on atmospheric conditions multiple times a day. And the rest comes from faster and more powerful computers, as well as a better understanding of atmospheric physics and dynamics, which makes it possible to take those observations and feed them into climate system computer models that can predict the likeliest fates for these storms. Researchers have deployed a variety of methods to collect real-time observations of a storm's wind speeds and other characteristics, including Hurricane Hunter plane flights into storms, autonomous gliders that collect ocean measurements of heat and salinity, and the Defense Meteorological Satellite Program, which helps identify changes to storm intensity and structure. Such real-time data is particularly important when it comes to anticipating whether and when a storm system might rapidly organize itself and suddenly intensify into a major hurricane, as Katrina did in the Gulf. Hurricane Hunter planes that fly into storms and collect data from within the maelstrom have significantly increased the accuracy of the track forecast, researchers reported in July in Weather and Forecasting. The researchers analyzed errors on forecast tracks before and after surveillance missions into storms from 2018 to 2022. Those improvements, the researchers suggest, may have come from better knowledge of the position of the storm and better understanding of the wind steering the storm's direction, reducing forecast track errors by as much as 24%. Satellite data has also provided data crucial to more accurate forecasts. NOAA satellites such as the GOES-16 satellite that went online in 2017 began providing increasingly high-resolution images of the top cloud layer, and the Department of Defense's constellation of weather satellites, which observe Earth using the microwave portion of the electromagnetic spectrum, are able to penetrate the clouds, offering information on temperature, moisture, and precipitation. All of these data make it possible to see inside a storm, assess its structure, and determine the likelihood of its strengthening. Researchers also recognize that improving computer models would be key to reducing forecast errors and providing more accurate warning. So in the wake of the Atlantic Ocean's hyperactive, deadly, and costly 2004 and 2005 hurricane seasons, in 2007, the National Hurricane Center initiated the Hurricane Forecast Improvement Project, a collaboration among numerous agencies and labs to make hurricane track and intensity forecasts, as well as forecasts of storm hazards, such as storm surges, more accurate and more reliable, and give communities in their potential path more time to prepare. The ambitious goal of the project was to improve forecast tracks by 50%. That goal has been more than met, says Jeff Masters, a hurricane scientist who flew with the NOAA Hurricane Hunters from 1986 to 1990. Track forecasts have seen a huge improvement since 2005, with track errors for all lead times improved by about 50% to well over 50%, end quote. For example, in the 2000s, forecasts for where a hurricane might go within 4 days could be off by over 300 kilometers, about the distance from the Florida Panhandle to New Orleans. Today, the errors on a 4-day track forecast have shrunk to around 200 kilometers, according to data from NOAA's National Hurricane Center. That means that, quote, a situation like we had in 2005 with the track of Katrina suddenly shifting 200 miles for NHC forecasts issued 12 hours apart is much less likely to occur, Masters says. Quote, this will give people more time to prepare, increasing the odds of lower death tolls and damages. End quote. Intensity forecasts, too, have made great strides. In 2022, NOAA, NOAA, announced its, quote, next generation, end quote, hurricane model of the hurricane analysis and forecast system, which is able to track multiple active tropical storms at the same time. That allows researchers to better observe how these storms influence one another, something that has previously been difficult to incorporate into computer models. This way of tracking simultaneous storms can improve predictions of a particular storm's future intensity by as much as 30%, researchers reported in the Bulletin of the American Meteorological Society. Do better forecasts reduce the costs of storms? 4 days isn't a lot of time for big damage preventing strategies such as building back protective wetlands or raising seawalls, but it is enough time for federal, state, and local governments to take some protective action, such as evacuating communities in the path of the storm, installing temporary levees, or deploying emergency generators to hospitals. And this accelerated improvement in U.S. forecasts has already translated not only to lives saved, but also to less costly storms. An analysis of the economic impact of over 30 land-falling hurricanes in the U.S. between 2005 and 2022 suggests that improved forecasts beginning around 2007, the result of the Hurricane Forecast Improvement Program, or HFIP, reduced the price tag of later hurricanes by 19%, or about $2 billion. By comparison, the cost of the Hurricane Forecast Improvement Program from 2009 to 2019 was only about $300 million, says environmental and natural resource economist Renato Molina of the University of Miami, who co-authored the study. The data show that HFIP was an unmitigated success, Molina says. Quote, you rarely see these kinds of returns in a government program. He says, quote, it's top-notch. There's nothing I can say that's negative about the program, end quote. but the picture isn't entirely rosy. Climate change could erase much of those gains by reducing the forecastability of hurricanes in the future, Molina says. Hurricanes are becoming more dangerous as Earth's climate warms, bigger, rainier, penetrating farther inland, and increasingly explosively and swiftly intensifying into major storms, fueled by rising ocean water temperatures. A Climate Central analysis of tropical cyclone intensification rates from 1971 to 2020 shows that the number of Atlantic storms that quickly intensified from a Category 1 to a Category 3 or higher hurricane within 24 hours more than doubled in that time. Warm ocean waters are a leading culprit. Sea surface temperatures in the Gulf of Mexico have increased by about 1 degree Celsius since the 1950s. The Atlantic Ocean's very warm waters juiced up devastating hurricanes Harvey and Maria in 2017. What would really reduce the future costs of hurricanes, Molina says, would be for the United States to commit to long-run adaptations like seawalls and wetland restoration against the likelihood of future hurricane impacts. Such adaptations, he and colleagues determined, could double the amount saved per hurricane. Forecast progress may be in jeopardy. On the heels of its success, the HFIP now has set itself new goals to provide even more lead time for forecasts. Those include creating computer simulations of the structure of a storm's inner core 7 days out from its landfall, and lengthening the lead time for forecasts of a hurricane's wind speed, rapid intensification, storm surge, and rain. But looming cuts to NOAA's budget threaten many of the gains, potentially eliminating funding for satellites, storm observations, and staff. The future of the Hurricane Hunter program is uncertain, with many of its staff eliminated in early 2025. The Department of Defense announced that it would no longer provide its weather satellite data to NOAA as of June 30th. That decision was later reversed and postponed to September 2026. What will happen to that satellite data after that date remains unclear. The administration's proposed budget would reduce support for researchers at labs that work on computer simulations, including at the National Center for Atmospheric Research and at Princeton University. The Trump administration has also proposed dramatic cuts to the Federal Emergency Management Agency, including the possibility of eliminating it altogether. On August 25th, 191 current and former FEMA employees, only 35 of whom attached their names for fear of retaliation, signed the, quote, Katrina Declaration, end quote, an open letter to Congress to, quote, sound the alarm, end quote, that the agency's current trajectory reflects a clear departure from efforts made in the wake of that disaster not to repeat the agency's shortcomings. On August 27th, FEMA suspended more than 20 employees who had signed the letter. As climate change increases the frequency and severity of hazards, annual losses due to disasters is projected to double in many countries around the Gulf Coast by 2050. A study by the Urban Research Institute, using data from the U.S. Federal Emergency Management Agency's Future Risk Index, found that Gulf Coast states are projected to lose $32 billion per year under a, quote, middle of the road, end quote, warming scenario, compared with $15 billion if global warming is not considered. A repeated barrage by storms makes recovery particularly challenging, Rumbach says. Quote, a large part of the Gulf has gotten hit again and again and again. It's really difficult to recover once. It's more difficult to recover multiple times, end quote. The data clearly show that it makes sense to continue our investment in hurricane research, quote, which have brought about these huge advancements in forecast accuracy, Master says, quote, but given the multiple losses in forecasting capability that have occurred this year, This progress may halt or even reverse beginning in 2025, end quote. And that's particularly untimely, he says, because climate change is increasing the odds that hurricanes will rapidly intensify, many just before landfall, giving little time to coastal communities to prepare or evacuate. Quote, these are the most dangerous types of hurricanes, end quote. And now from the news of physics, a ringing black hole matches scientists' predictions. Gravitational waves emitted after two black holes coalesced agree with theories. By Emily Conover. Newly reported gravitational waves rang out as clear as a bell. Spotted in January, these space-time ripples are the clearest yet discovered, cutting through the background noise better than any previous detection. The waves were born when two black holes merged, forming a larger black hole that reverberated like a struck bell emitting gravitational waves as its vibrations gradually faded. The peeling of this black hole matched predictions of black hole behavior, according to physicists' theory of gravity, general relativity. The team reports September 10th in Physical Review Letters. Quote, just by hearing a bell, you understand it's a big bell rather than a small bell, says Caltech physicist Katarina Chatsianow, a co-author of the study. Quote, the frequencies that an object makes when you strike it are unique to it, and the same thing is true with black holes, end quote. Like actual bells, black holes ring with a fundamental pitch and other frequencies called overtones that fade away more quickly. For the newly reported merger, both the fundamental and the first overtone were detected by the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory in Hanford, Washington, and Livingston, Louisiana. The event was comparable to previous black hole mergers seen. The two initial black holes each had masses about 30 times that of the Sun, similar to the first black hole merger, LIGO, detected in 2015. Improvements to LIGO's detectors in the 10 years since allowed this signal to come through particularly loud and clear, about 80 times as prominent as the background noise compared with the signal-to-noise ratio of 26 for LIGO's first detection. The measurements match the predictions for a Kerr black hole based on a solution to the equations of general relativity first worked out by New Zealand mathematician Roy Kerr in 1963. Kerr's solution describes black holes that are spinning as realistic black holes are expected to. Similar tests have been tried before with gravitational wave data, but this is the first time such a clear overtone has been detected, which is necessary for this type of test. Chatsianow says. The team also checked a prediction developed by physicist Stephen Hawking in the 1970s called the Area Theorem. It states that the surface area of black hole event horizons can only grow with time. The newly formed black hole had a surface area larger than the sum of the two original ones, matching Hawking's rule. While scientists previously tested Hawking's area theorem with the first black hole merger, LIGO detected, the improved signal-to-noise in this new event allowed for a more definitive check. From the News of Neuroscience, your red is my red, at least to our brains. Brain scans reveal a common neural signature when people see red, green, or yellow, by Laura Sanders. It's a late-night debate in college dorms across the world. Is my red the same as your red? Two neuroscientists weigh in on this classic, quote, intro to philosophy, end quote, puzzler in research published September 8th in the Journal of Neuroscience. Their answer is a resounding maybe. There were two possibilities when it comes to how brains perceive color, says Andreas Bartels of the University of Tübingen and the Max Planck Institute for Biological Cybernetics in Germany. Perhaps everyone's brain is unique with the bespoke snowflake patterns of nerve cells responding when a person sees red, or it could be that seeing red kicks off a standard predictable pattern of brain activity that doesn't vary much from person to person? The answer is overwhelmingly the second option, the new study suggests. Quote, there are commonalities across brains, Bartels says. Along with colleague Michael Bannert, Bartels first monitored the activity of nerve cells spread across visual brain areas as 15 people saw shades of reds, greens, and yellows. The team then used those benchmarks to predict what color a person was looking at based solely on the individual's pattern of brain activity. The results show that neural reactions to colors are somewhat standard and don't seem to vary much from person to person. But these neuroanatomical findings can't answer the question of how it feels to see red, Bartels says. How brain activity creates subjective inner experiences is a much bigger and thornier question about consciousness, one that will no doubt continue to be debated for a long time. Well, that's all the time we have for today. This has been Bill Shaw with Science News. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading from the Audio Reading Service at the Allen County Public Library.